and lawyers and human beings.
Okay, the next argued case is number 172673, Minnemeyer against Auerbach Representatives Incorporated. Mr. McAndrews.
I've visited the court many times, Your Honor. Not with my reading glasses, so bear with me, just a moment of adjustment here. Time marches on, I suppose.
Okay.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, and very best wishes to Judge Lori, who I understand is listening in for a speedy recovery, Judge. So our patent system has many objectives, but one of the primary objectives is not just to protect the interests of the inventor or the patent holder, Mr. Minnemeyer in this case. Another important interest is to protect those of the competitors in the marketplace. In this case, my clients, Mr. and Mrs. Lundeen, and their co-defendants. And, as importantly, the public. That objective failed in this case for two primary reasons. You've seen the arguments in our brief.
Your main argument seems to be that Nautilus v. Biosig, a Polestar case, represented a sea change in the law such that you couldn't raise the defense of indefiniteness until 2014.
We present that as our second argument, Your Honor, but it is equally compelling, and I agree. I think Nautilus absolutely represents a sea change.
What case support do you have where we allowed a party to assert for the first time into a seven-year litigation the defense of indefiniteness based upon Nautilus?
Your Honor, I believe you sat on the Dow Chemical panel. And my reading of the Dow Chemical case is that issues of claim preclusion, res judicata, and law of the case do not apply on facts such as these.
Dow Chemical had nothing to do with leave to amend, but it was about whether, in light of Nautilus, we were bound by our decision in a previous pre-Nautilus appeal that claims were not indefinite.
Your Honor, I think the legal, the overriding legal issue of a substantial change.
How can you say Dow Chemical applies when RBOC never once presented any indefiniteness defense until 7 years into the litigation and 2 years after the first trial had already run?
Indeed, we initially did present, and that was brief to the lower court, but I think for the purposes of appeal, the point is that immediately after...
Wait, go backwards.
Yes.
Indeed, we did initially present.
I'm sorry. We pled indefiniteness, and then we withdrew it as we moved on in the proceedings. Within 2 weeks, as we said in our brief, Judge Wallach, of the Supreme Court's decision in Nautilus, we moved for leave to amend our contentions, our expert report. We did something else, though. We also filed a motion for summary judgment that the magistrate judge granted a briefing schedule on and considered.
Finding abuse of discretion under a district court's application of local rules is a pretty high bar when it comes to a proposed amendment.
Admittedly, it is a high bar, but one of the hallmarks of abuse of discretion is a misapplication of the law. And on that count, we think the magistrate got it wrong.
Do you have a case where
on the issue?
Do you have a case where a party waited 7 years into litigation to raise an indefinite defense, and was allowed to amend?
I don't have a case, but
you knew it was possible because you say you initially started with it and then abandoned it.
We did, but we were also presenting those arguments at the time on indefiniteness and considering them, Your Honor, in the context of the law as it existed at the time. So, yes, Nautilus was a sea change, With respect to the abuse of discretion standard, we cited the law that this court will apply the law of the regional circuit on issues of law that are to be considered de novo. Waiver is one of those issues. And we think the magistrate judge got the issue of waiver wrong on an incredibly important issue here.
Just out of curiosity, is it our BOC or our BOC?
It's Auerbach. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't want to correct you. And in fact, when you first said encounter, I was considering, is that an acronym for a post-Dow case that I should be aware of?
So why did Auerbach ever stipulate to the approximately perpendicular claim to mean approximately 90 degrees in lieu of a Markman hearing?
Yeah, and to be fair to Mr. and Mrs. Lundeen, they're here today. They didn't stipulate to it. I stipulated to it at the time.
Well, you are them.
I am them. Of course, I am. I stand in their shoes. In looking at the context of Claim 12 with the numerous what we are calling the applicable terms that appear in the glossary, I can give the citation, and I will in a moment. Perpendicular, we do understand to be 90 degrees. That's the reference point. But there is uncertainty throughout the record. We cited in the brief to the testimony of Mr. Minnemeyer himself, where he said, when I questioned him on it at his deposition, then at trial of Minnemeyer 1, I note that Your Honors, Newman and Wallach, sat on the panel back in 2013.
I remember it.
For our first go-around. These are significantly different circumstances, of course. We're dealing with a redesigned product here. And we want to foster the concept of redesign and competition. But to the point, Mr. Minnemeyer's response to my question at trial, what is approximately perpendicular? The magistrate judge identified Mr. Minnemeyer as one of ordinary skill in the art. The skilled artisan's testimony was, good question, probably not a lot past 5 degrees. Not surprising, the design specification for Mr. Minnemeyer's own Lausanne product, which is the commercial embodiment in this case.
I seem to recall references to 80 degrees.
There are, and let me cite to a footnote that at least I have used, the district court did. We are speaking in terms of complementary angles. We did so throughout the proceedings below. And I think you'll see in the briefing, use of complementary angles is replete in footnotes. We include the explanatory. Complementary angles are easily reconciled because the sum of the two always equal the right angle, not 90 degrees here. So to flip it, Mr. Minnemeyer's testimony would have been translating. It would have been good question. Not a lot past 85 degrees, not a lot less than 85 degrees, because we're flipping it. He went on. He said, you start getting...
Except I seem to recall seeing 80, a mention of 70.
I'm sorry, you're recalling from the 2013 Minnemeyer 1.
I think I'm recalling from the record here.
So perhaps the points of reference... If I may use the complementary angles, as we did and the magistrate judge did. 5 degrees was the design specification and the undisputed measurement of Mr. Minnemeyer's Lausanne coupler.
I think we better touch on TiVo.
TiVo. So right out of the chute in the magistrate's 72-page opinion, he expressed his...
How can you argue the court used the incorrect test to determine continued infringement from TiVo when the court expressly performed both prongs of the TiVo analysis?
I don't agree that I agree, Your Honor, that the court said it recognized the law under TiVo. The first thing the judge did was express confusion as to why you need to reach the issue of infringement once... there has been a finding that a redesigned product is no more than colorably different from an originally adjudicated infringing product. Of course, in this case, we're talking about the original BNC coupler versus the redesigned BNC coupler. Appendix page 49, I'd call the court's attention to that. The court quotes, in speaking of the two-pronged TiVo test, therein lies the rub, because in case after case, the Federal Circuit also tells us that when differences between devices are merely colorable, that means they are essentially the same, which in turn means the collateral estoppel applies in a finding of infringement, I don't have my glasses on, is appropriate, close quote. An argument embraced throughout the proceeding below by our colleagues representing Mr. Minnemeyer. I do not agree that that is the standard. It is certainly not the standard post-TiVo. On the next page, appendix page 50, the court went on in expressing how it was perplexed.
Yeah. So let's talk about 50 and 51.
Yes.
The blue brief at 51 and 52 suggests that the district court improperly considers subjective intent and state of mind. And when it, as part of its analysis, citing to 50 and 51 in the JA, where the district court says, if changes were made to the angles of the threads, they seem for the most part unintentional, and that Auerbach executives did not even know any such changes were made to the thread angles. In the red brief, it points out that those are only partial quotes from the district court's determination that weighed the credibility of both parties' witnesses' testimony. And I looked, and indeed they are only partial quotes. Do you still allege, looking at the entire language, I've got it all underlined, do you still allege that district court imported some type of intent element?
Based on what is cited at what I understand to be 50 and 51 of the blue book, yeah, you mentioned, Your Honor?
Our no, 51 and 52 of the blue brief. I didn't want to confuse you. That's why I was trying to.
No.
50 and 51 of the record.
Based on not just what is cited on this page, but elsewhere in our brief and elsewhere within appendix 49 through 56, which is the purported infringement section. It's the infringement section of the district court's analysis. It is very clear that the court considered intent. It spoke of haphazard arrangement. There's reference elsewhere, Your Honor. And perhaps I may not be able to cue myself up to it right now on the fly, but I will certainly do so.
I'll bet your opposing counsel will help you.
Perhaps. That is one of the several assignments of error. The further point the court made about the conundrum, my term, not the court's, the TiVo conundrum. So if this line of cases, again referring to the Federal Circuit Authority, all 2008 pre-TiVo cases, tells us that a device that is no more than colorably different from a device also found to infringe, why then does TiVo require a second step of analysis after the no more than colorably different finding, which the court reached in this case relative to the first two? The answer is we don't know. And while we suspect the issue of infringement has been settled, that is, the district court is saying it suspects the issue of infringement has been resolved by virtue of the first prong of the test. But that is precisely what TiVo was designed to change. There still must be a finding under 271 of infringement. In this case, importantly, Your Honors, it has to be literal infringement. Why? As in Minnemeyer 1, in Minnemeyer 2, Mr. Minnemeyer expressly waived reliance on the doctrine of equivalence. Why does TiVo require the separate analysis, infringement after a finding of essential sameness, which is the terms that my colleagues used in the proceedings below? Perhaps an analogy. If there is a bicycle wheel with 28 spokes, that's the original product, and you have a redesigned product that's the same bicycle wheel, or it's a bicycle wheel with 32 spokes, they may be essentially the same under the colorable differences analysis? Are they used for the same purpose? Certainly. I put it on the front or the rear of my bicycle. Are they used to support someone in a vehicle in motion with pedals? Yes, they are. However, when you get to the issues that matter in a patent infringement case, which is how do the claim terms, as construed, apply to the accused product, you're not comparing products there. You're comparing claim language to accused product. It can be all the difference in the world because the claim may specify a bicycle wheel wherein there are 28 spokes. That's why the distinction is important. We argued exhaustively on that point to the district court. It seemed to be lost on the court, and it certainly was on our colleagues. They literally argued throughout trial and their post-trial, and we've cited their excerpts to you, that you don't need to reach the second prong of TiVo upon a finding of colorable differences. It's a critical difference. Some of the specific...
Let's hear. We're into your rebuttal time, so we'll save the rebuttal, but let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. Was I over time? I was showing I had 35 seconds.
No. You were 35 over.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay. He can take my time. I'm sure I won't use it all up.
Mr. Chalmers.
May it please the court.
Why don't you start, just elucidate for your opposing counsel what the court actually said at 50 and 51 in the appendix.
Well, in 50 and 51, the court was...
It just doesn't look like to me like he imported intent.
Importing intent. Well, there is a great deal of intent in the case generally because, of course, the court found they had a global credibility problem,
right.
Lied about almost everything of any importance, and...
saying that it was like Kronos's good luck piece by happenstance, there was an element of, I think if he imported anything, it was sarcasm.
Oh, without doubt, and the absurdity of it was what impressed the court more than anything, and that's the tone he took in his opinion, because these arguments would come out of nowhere with no evidence to support them, no documentary record, admissions contrary to the current argument, the prior verdict, the claim construction being stipulated and then evaded, try to circumvent that constantly. So they all of these things that the court, I think, looked at with some hostility and certainly played into its triple damage and fees award at the end. So I can't blame the judge for, not compartmentalizing all of these things 100%. However, when it comes to TiVo, there's no doubt he followed the letter of the law on that case because, sure, he had collateral estoppel based on no colorable differences, something they don't appeal here. And that would be the Halco line of cases and the others he cites for that. I don't think TiVo reversed that line of cases at all. And in fact, in footnote 4 of the TiVo case, it says the court's free to employ any traditional means of proof that are available, such as collateral estoppel. But then he went on and did it anyway. And in 50-51 is exactly where he kind of summarizes that, although there are other parts in the opinion where he talks about infringement. But he takes four basic approaches to it. One is the common sense approach that says, we had an infringing product at the first trial. There were no changes, so just a matter of common sense, this one infringes too. Then he also does the colorable difference, applies that nonetheless. Then he goes on and compares Kaiser's testimony. He doesn't quote it all in his opinion. We give it to the court in our brief, where Kaiser says 75 is approximately perpendicular, just like 80 was the first.
That's what I was recalling, yes.
Yes, so the whole premise of the second trial was that they wanted to say it was 80 versus 75, and they couldn't explain how it changed, but it did. The only change really was a new expert who remeasured stuff, because they were always that in that range. And the court then gets down and compares Mr. Kaiser Our guy on 75, he says it's approximately perpendicular. Their guy, Mr. Krajewski, who makes the product, you know, this is it, by the way. It's nothing technologically special. But Mr. Krajewski, the guy who molded it, he said, whatever, it's approximately perpendicular at 75. And then the court contrasts that with their expert, Dr. Storis, who was in the clouds, head in the clouds, and wasn't dealing with the product or the claim language approximately perpendicular. So I don't know how anybody could read the court's opinion and somehow say that he flubbed TiVo. Now, a couple things I noticed from the first part of the argument here. The court was interested to know why they stipulated a claim construction approximately 90 degrees. That was something of a gift. They could have contested that then. And maybe at that point, Minnemeyer's testimony about what his product was at could have been relevant. There are cases, though, that say that inventor testimony is irrelevant to claim scope. So we would have had that fight, and maybe we would have pegged it at 75 or 60, which is a standard thread, 60 degrees. But we didn't do that. And so neither did the jury the first time around say it's 80 and no less. And the judge notices that, too. So obviously you're dealing with plastics. You're dealing with the width of a human hair on these things. And so, all things considered, 75 infringes, and that's his independent, supported opinion. And I think it'd be awfully hard to say that he clearly erred in making it. Nautilus, that may be the primary argument, honestly, but it's not.
I thought it was that.
They put some effort. They put some effort into it. But the court's right. There's no support for it in Dow. That was a totally different situation. And I don't even see the issue as one of waiver because the court used that term and they key on it. But all the court was doing was saying, look, you raised it, you abandoned it, and now you want to bring it back because it's convenient. But I don't see the landscape is changing. Your arguments all involve the old cases before Nautilus.
Whether the test was the old test or the new test, I don't see a different result.
No, and certainly even if you were to reach the merits, it's got approximately perpendicular. There's a firm end on there. But anyway, that's a moot question too, because I think as we note in the briefs, once the colorable difference question is settled, then that cuts out these defenses, including this Nautilus defense. So it really doesn't get them anywhere at the end of the day, since they don't appeal colorable differences. They're stuck. That's all I have, unless there are additional questions. He can have my rebuttal time.
Thank you for the rebuttal, counsel. So, a couple of points. On the issue and the refrain that we hear, that nothing changed between the original coupler and the redesign. First of all, we have to focus on the issues at Barr and Minnemeyer too. Certainly something changed, because by Mr. Minnemeyer's own admission, he dropped assertion of claims 2, 3, and 4 of the 726 patent. And the reason is, and I would direct the court's attention to page 19 of our main brief. May I hold this up? This has an image that contrasts the trial exhibits.
It's in your brief, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. It's page 19 of our main brief, the blue book.
Okay.
The upper coupler is a cross section or a half section, if you will, of the BNC redesign that's at issue in Minnemeyer 2. The lower of the two images is a half section, the cross section of the original BNC coupler at issue in Minnemeyer 1. You will see reference with our annotation to a sealing surface. That's a smooth annular seal ring that appears on either side of what is called the raised center stop. That came out between the two products. That is a critical distinction. Colorable Differences talks about a product-to-product comparison. And in that respect, you do look at the old and the new. It's hard to claim that the redesigned product is the very same as the original product when Mr. Minnemeyer had to drop his assertion of claims 2, 3, and 4, each of which is addressed to that smooth sealing surface. You see, it's no longer there. The other critical point, and this comes, we will arrive at what is relevant to this case, which are the thread angles, the approximately perpendicular, approximately 90 degree limitation. You'll see that the raised center stop of the original coupler is much wider. And so when you take the additional width of the center stop with those sealing surfaces and then look right up above to the redesigned product, what appear there? Additional threads. This notion that there were not additional threads cut into the core inserts, which are the internal part of the mold that create these, it is a preposterous theory, and yet that was the refrain that we heard at trial. Nothing has changed about these. By the way, the only thing that changed is a new expert. The insinuation from my colleague that we just got a new expert who came up with these magical 75 degree measurements. The first measurements we had in the case came from Stephen Kaiser, Mr. Minnemeyer's expert witness. Every single one of his 126 discrete measurements, not of the old product, of the new product, averaged 74.65 degrees. Of course something changed. Further, Mr. Kaiser admitted at trial that the threads that he measured were the three threads closest to the center stop on either side. What does that mean based on the clear construction, the clear structure of each of these? He was measuring threads that were newly cut, that didn't even exist on the core inserts used to manufacture the original products. And on that count, there is no dispute the measurements are 75 degrees. I think when you look at the district court's portion of the infringement analysis, they accept that 75 degrees is the measurement.
Okay, we need to wrap it up. What's your last advice? We've exhausted the time. Is there anything you need to direct us to, particularly that's in your brief, that we can concentrate on?
There is, Your Honor. In our brief and in the appendix, we assign about 7 points of error. Plastic parts were the construed claim construction. Pages appendix 51 through 56, there is a lengthy excerpt of Mr. Kaiser's trial testimony where the district court highlights it, gives us a roadmap for the legal error on the application of the literal infringement analysis. He focuses on, as I said, manufacturing tolerances. They don't appear any.
We're not redoing the jury verdict, you understand?
No, I understand. I'm talking strictly about the court's application of the legal test for literal infringement. If the result stands, if the judgment stands, it's bad for competition. It's terrible for my clients in this case, and it's bad for the public. The court misapplied the literal infringement test. Didn't apply it at all, as we say in pages.
Okay, thank you. We'll take it all under consideration.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All rise. The case is under submission.